For the rest of us, I was reminded this past week of a story I shared some years ago. It was this time when on his way home, this man's car stalled at an intersection in the midst of some heavy traffic. And as the light turned from red to green, he, despite all his efforts to start this car, he simply could not get it to start. He could not get the engine to turn over. At the same time, this chorus of honking horns begins to grow louder behind him. So finally he gets out of his car and he walks to the car directly behind him. And he says, "I am so sorry. Please forgive me, but I just cannot seem to get my car started. Perhaps if you would be so willing to go up and try to start my car for me, and I will stay here and continue honking your horn for you." In a word, today is about patience. About patience, something that is often so hard to come by and yet is absolutely central, we can think last week, to Paul, right? Is absolutely so central to what is this way of reconciliation. Absolutely central to what it means to travel the path of forgiveness. In fact, turn with me back just for a moment this morning to Matthew chapter 18. The words will be on the screen behind me, Pew Bible, page 695. So whatever your choice is there is just fine. Matthew 18, verse 21. We read there, "Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, 'Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times?'" So again, Peter here, he is asking Jesus, right? He is asking him about this way of forgiveness. Right, what was a way that is absolutely central, again, think last week, to the way of reconciliation. And here is Peter, and he says to Jesus, "Jesus, give me a number. Tell me, how many times do I have to do this thing called forgiveness? Give me a number." Verse 22, Jesus answered, "I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times." That can also be translated 70 times seven. Often that's found in your footnotes, or perhaps they've got it in parentheses right there. But 70 times seven, again, is 490, tamim in the Hebrew, meaning complete or finished, or this idea of being whole, right? And so Jesus steps in and he says, no, hold on, Peter. This is about more than a number, right? This is about your heart. This is about the posture of your heart. Now, you can go back and listen to last week's message. It's online, either through the website or through iTunes. But if you were here last week, you also remember that Jesus then began to tell this story. And as I got to thinking about that this past week, I began to realize and understand that nestled into this story of forgiveness, kind of sitting quietly along the path, is this the importance of, or the significance of patience. Verse 25, "Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him." And then this is what he said. He said, "Be patient with me. Be patient with me," he begged. And then again, verse 29, "His fellow servant fell to his knees begging, 'Be patient with me, and I will pay it back.'" Right? Into this story of forgiveness, woven into this story of forgiveness, is the significance of patience. Makrothumeo in the Greek. Often translated patience or forbearance, makrothumeo. It's composed of two, kind of a compound, right? So you have makros, which means long. You have thumos, which is passion. And so this kind of idea of long passion. Sometimes it's been described as someone who would have a long temper or a slow fuse. It's been described or defined as putting up with a suffering without responding in anger, enduring a wrong without seeking or taking revenge. But even more than that, makrothumeo, this way of patience, this way of bearing up under, this way of enduring a wrong, really it goes the way of righteousness and justice. It speaks the language of righteousness and justice. And in that sense, not only moves us then to resist the honking of the horn, but actually moves us to get out of the car and to offer compassion, right? To lend a helping hand, to do good, to be a blessing. We see this play out in Matthew 5 and verse 10, specifically, and not specifically as to the word, but in its essence, in its overall essence. And here we read from chapter 5 and 10, Jesus is speaking. He says, blessed are those who are persecuted. Now, quick pause, because if you're anything like me, you read a word like persecuted, and I tend to think of not so much myself, but I think of those that are overseas. I think those that are in harm's way out there somewhere. I think of someone like Trinity in Indonesia. She's playing in her church play yard in the playground at the church there, and her parents are inside. She's with her friend Anton, or her parents are inside at a meeting, and a Molotov cocktail explodes and engulfs her body in flames. Anton is killed. I think of Rohan and Neha in India, and how one evening they heard a knock at the door, and not expecting any visitors, they kind of opened up and looked outside, and there's this mob of people accusing them of trying to share Jesus with a young boy. They began beating my wife and I, Rohan said, until we bled. And then they killed our child. The trauma was so much that my wife later lost the baby she was carrying. And so we read of that, right? And we feel the ache, right? We hear of persecution and we feel that kind of ache. In fact, the word persecute, dioko, is used of a hunter who is pursuing his catch. This strong desire to apprehend. And so we can easily read about persecution and think, yes, it's for those people out there. But what does it mean for me? What does it mean for me in my world, right where I live? And I'm glad you asked that, because I think there is something here for us this morning. Verse 10, if we continue on reading, it says, blessed are those who are persecuted. And then we read, because of righteousness. Now, righteousness is a word we must be careful with, mostly because it is easy to reduce righteousness to an external behavioral standard. And with that, then, those who are righteous are those who have somehow attained to living this external behavioral standard. In other words, righteousness really, in its simplest form, becomes a list of do's and don'ts. And the righteous, then, are those who do the do's and don't do the don'ts, right? The problem is, limited to that view, we all too easily become judge and jury. Judge and jury of one another. We all too easily begin to value and devalue another based on some external behavioral standard, some external criteria. The emphasis, however, I would argue, summed up in the teachings of Jesus, moves us away from that kind of a self-centered external behavioral standard and moves us toward what I would call a community-centered interpersonal relational ethic. And in that sense, then, righteousness now centers on compassion, centers on caring for the poor, on healing the sick, feeding the hungry, caring for the naked, clothing the naked, or just really about anything else that Jesus ever said. And specifically, we can think of Matthew 25. Meaning, righteousness in that sense is not about a behavior to be managed, and it's more about an experience of connection to be shared. Righteousness is less about a behavior to be managed and more about a connection with one another. In other words, to borrow from one of my illustrations from some time back, it's less about the speed limit and it's more about care and safety for one another. Right? Because I can be driving down my street 25 miles per hour. I can be driving down my street. I'm going 25 miles per hour and I am righteous. Right? There is an external standard of behavior and I have attained to it. 25 miles an hour, I'm good. I am being righteous. As I'm driving down my street being righteous, I see a bicyclist And maybe that bicyclist isn't quite so steady. Something's not quite wrong or not quite right. And so pretty soon there's an accident and the bicyclist is hurt. But hey, external behavioral standard says I was driving 25 miles an hour. I was righteous, right? I was doing the righteous thing. I was being righteous. But that is only if we view righteousness as that kind of behavioral standard, as some kind of personal purity, as something that I'm seeking to attain to. Again, as a self-centered, external behavioral standard versus a community-centered, interpersonal, relational ethic. And the way of Jesus moves righteousness absolutely toward this community-centered, interpersonal, relational sort of ethic, meaning that the speed limit really isn't about me. The speed limit really isn't about me. It's not for me. We could say it's for us. Right? And in that sense, the speed limit isn't really about limiting speed as much as it is care and compassion for one another. To think of the speed limit not as a behavioral standard to which I attain, but to see it as a community-oriented opportunity for deep compassion and care for one another. We see this come to pass in the ancient languages. Righteousness, dikaiosune, carries this idea of a life or a lifestyle, much in the same way that forgiveness does, right? It's not a momentary stop, but it's an ongoing, never-ending sort of approach or attitude, right? A posture that is molded, that is bent, that is bending toward justice. In Hebrew, the righteous or the righteousness is from tzedek, and it's interesting because it also can be translated as justice, mainly because those two words can be are very intimately connected in the ancient Hebrew language. Adele Just, writing a framework for justice, she notes, when a person is seen as righteous, it is not so much that he is virtuous, but rather when it comes to relationships between humans, righteous action is that which promotes a sense of well-being and peace for the whole community. And we can think of Jesus' life, right? The whole of Jesus' life. Just continues, particularly in the prophetic books, righteousness includes the idea of helping the poor and the needy. One cannot be in right relationship with God while neglecting his fellow man. We see this come to pass in Matthew 20 and 28, right? Jesus, it says, came to not to be served, but to serve, right? To bring righteousness and justice, to bear on the outcast, on the lowly, on the poor, on the one in need. In the words of verse 11 from 5, Matthew 5 and verse 11, blessed are you when people insult you, right? Meaning mock you, revile you, persecute you, right? Subject you to prejudice. We could say subject you to injustice and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. We can turn back to Mark chapter 2, the opening line. This is in Capernaum here, and four men have brought a paralyzed man to Jesus. There's not enough, they don't find a way to get close to Jesus, so they go up and they lower him down through a roof. In verse 5, we read, when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralyzed man, son, your sins are forgiven. Now, some teachers of the law were sitting there thinking to themselves, why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Right? And so here is Jesus, forgiving, healing, caring, compassion, loving, and he is persecuted. And there is makrothumeo. Dropping down to verse 23, one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields and his disciples walked along. They began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisee said to him, look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? He answered, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar, the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.'" Chapter 3, verse 1. Another time Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is it lawful on the Sabbath to do, good or to do evil, to save life or to kill it?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and, deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Are we getting this? Jesus, right? He's feeding. He's doing good. He's healing. And he is persecuted. And there is macrothumeo. Luke 5, "Then Levi held a great banquet for Jesus at his house, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who belonged to their sect complained to his disciples, 'Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?'" Again, Jesus. Right? Hospitality. Eating with. Relationship. Care, compassion, connection. And he is persecuted, and there is macrothumeo. Over and over again, all throughout the Gospels, one more from Luke 14, Jesus tells the parable of the great banquet. You can read it on your own later, but here's a summary from Michael Hoodman. He says that the invitation is opened up to societies maimed and downtrodden is important. These were the types of people that the Pharisees considered unclean and under God's curse. Jesus, however, taught that the kingdom was available even to those considered unclean. His involvement with tax collectors and sinners brought condemnation from the Pharisees, yet it showed the extent of God's grace. That the master in the parable sends the servant far afield to persuade everyone to come indicates the offer of salvation extends to the most unlikely. Right? I mean, Jesus says, all are welcome, and he is persecuted, and there is macrothumeo. Right, for the sick, for the despised, for the despicable, for the outcast, for the one whose car has stalled during rush hour traffic. Where we not only then endure a wrong, but we extend forgiveness. Where we not only resist retaliation, but we offer compassion. Where we stop honking the horn and instead we offer a helping hand. Are we embracing this way of patience? Macrothumeo. Are we embracing this way of patience? We could ask, are we willing to endure suffering without retaliation? Are we willing to endure suffering without, do we bear up under a wrong without responding in anger? To use the car analogy, do we hold our honk when the car in front of us isn't moving? Do we hold our honk when and that both literally and figuratively? Do we get out of the car and offer a helping hand? We could ask, do we create the space for righteousness and justice to thrive? Do we create the space for righteousness and justice to thrive? And in all of that, really to wonder, to ask, to spend some time with God. God, how are you inviting me to practice this way of patience? How are you inviting me to practice this way of patience today, in that situation, as I drive home? May we less and less see ourselves, see one another, see the world through a way of righteousness that centers around the self. That is self-centered, that is external. That is this outward measure of behavior. And more may we see righteousness as this community-oriented, community-centered, interpersonal, relational connection. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. Be patient, makrothumeo. Be patient with me, he begged.